Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Augustin Macellari.
On today's show, we'll be meeting the godfather of cyberpunk, William Gibson, as we unpack apocalyptic visions of alternative presents and distant futures in his new book, Agency.
Then we'll be sitting down with author and screenwriter Andrea Chalupa to explore how her family's experience of the Holodomor inspired her to write Mr. Jones.
And as London's Flowers Gallery celebrates its 50-year anniversary, we'll look back at a half century in the art world with managing director Matthew Flowers.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be looking ahead to next week's news today. All that ahead right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Tom, a change, a break from the norm. More accustomed to sitting here, I am, on Sundays with one Robert Bound.
Yeah, it's myself, Tom Edwards, in the chair.
How does it feel? Today. Sometimes you do as a news look ahead, but you haven't been co-hosting for a stint, have you?
Not for a while, but it's great to be back. Nowhere I'd rather be of a Sunday lunchtime. What have you been up to, Org? Any learnings from the past 7 days?
I haven't done anything really new in the past 7 days. Well, actually, I have. I'll tell you about that in a sec. I finished Succession, which I appreciate was 7 months after everyone else. But I like that. I thought it was good.
That's been one of my favourite shows in the last couple of years.
I also read William Gibson's new book in anticipation of meeting him for an interview for this very programme, which we'll be hearing in about 10 minutes.
How exciting. I mean, something of a legend.
He is a legend. Coined the term cyberspace, if you remember.
Yes, I do remember back that far. We deal with legendary figures, don't we, here on the Monocle Weekly?
Yeah, they're our stock in trade.
And what about, in a moment, we'll be looking ahead to next week's news today with Fernando, but anything you're looking forward to in the coming week?
Yes, Tom, I am. I'm looking forward to watching Uncut Gems on one of the premier streaming services online. You've seen it, I believe.
I haven't finished it yet. It's quite stressful.
Yeah, you got so too stressed, didn't you?
A lot of these things I can only watch in small, manageable chunks.
You had to it's 5 minute bite-sized, snackable content, I believe is the technical term.
Can I make a gem pun for you? It's a multifaceted movie. Do you like that?
I do, yeah.
That's good, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Shall I tell you someone else with many facets, always sparkling, a pleasure to be around, and may or may not be a girl's best friend? Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Hello, everyone.
Fernando, welcome.
I have such an exciting week, actually. And you know why? Because I will start already with my first and main story here. It's the Oscars today.
This very day.
It is a very special day for me since 97, I believe. I think it was the year where The English Patient won a few awards. Evita was there as well. That's the first one I can remember watching it live from Brazil. And let's be honest here, I know some people like it, some people don't like it. But nevertheless, we talk about it. It is a talking point. And even as our, you know, contributor Karen Krizanovich was telling me, you know, it is all about politics. You know, you can talk about, you know, the lack of diversity or, I mean, there's so much to discuss about the Oscars. What about you guys? Are you fans? Do you watch the event live?
It's
by
on
any chance?
Far too late for me. Fernando.
It is far
as you're
too
well
late.
Aware, long past my bedtime. But I do like all of the sort of machinations. Obviously, in the last few years, we've had snafus, technical problems, the wrong films getting named. And I kind of like it when an old-fashioned blunder is the thing that dominates the headlines. But this year, I wonder, are we still in that? There's obviously, as you mentioned, a lot of talk about how colourblind the Oscars are or are not. There's still the broiling, ongoing saga of Me Too and lack of representation of women in a lot of main categories. Is it going to be one of those very explicitly political events, do you think, tonight?
I don't think it will be the most political. I think even in last year's Oscars, I think the celebrities there toned it down a little bit, the criticism of Trump. But I think it could be an interesting one. I mean, there are some talk that Parasite could win for Best Film. I think that will be the first kind of foreign film winning such categories. So that will be quite special. But I mean, I wonder. I mean, I don't think they're favourite. I think 1917 is the favourite to win Best Movie, but we should wait and see.
Has the Oscars ever recovered from losing its host?
in fact, that was a good thing for the Oscars because it worked very well last year that the ratings went up a little bit. Not like they used to be, you know, in the 90s and in the noughties. But to be honest, I don't think they actually need a host because especially the Oscars, which is kind of aimed for everyone. I think the Golden Globes can work because they can do a little bit more kind of, you know, this kind of dark humor. They can be a bit funnier and edgier. I think at the Oscars is a bit quite restrictive in that sense. I think it works very well for them without a host. I mean, just get some comedians time to time to do like a 5 minute sketch. But I quite enjoyed without a host, actually.
Faye, where are we going next?
Well, it's still today. It's in Switzerland. You know, they love voting their referendums today. But this one today is very interesting. They're voting if they should criminalize anti-LGBTQ hate speech. I mean, you would say, oh, that's an obvious one. I mean, clearly, I think the majority of Swiss, they want to criminalize that. But there's been a lot of discussion, especially in the right-wing parties. They're saying that this could censor free speech. And, you know, the right in Switzerland is very powerful. But there's been so many aspects of that story. I think Coke, they usually don't do that, but they did a lot of ads in Swiss publications saying the Swiss should vote, you know, they're pro-equality. I think could be an interesting result. And even in my own country, we voted for the same thing last year only. I say we voted. Things happened differently. It was the Supreme Court that decided that homophobia is a crime. But again, there's been a lot of controversy in Brazil. So it's just quite an interesting, something that for some will be so obvious. Actually, there's quite a lot of discussion happening there. You know, I don't think the Swiss should worry too much about the aspect of free speech because in the law it says, it's not like if you're in your family's house and someone, you know, say something against you, you're not going to be persecuted. I think there's quite a lot of restrictions in the law itself. You know, I do hope they say yes to criminalize it. Let's see.
Fernando, time for one more?
Tom, maybe you remember that. I mean, we had a little bit of a, you know, when you do live interviews, some things can go wrong. We had, I believe, the organizer of this festival. At that time, I'm sure they've changed. It is, of course, the 87th annual Lemon Festival or the Fête du Citron.
Oh, yeah.
In the city of Menton, close to Côte d'Azur. I mean, we had a guest booked live. I mean, it wasn't such a great interview from what I can remember.
I think there's an anecdote here that I haven't been filled in on. Please, pray tell.
I would say this is going back. It could be 8 years or longer, early days of Monocle 24, and our august editor, Andrew Tuck, was in the chair for the briefing, and he spoke live to the organisers of the Menton Lemon Festival, the Festival du Citron, one presumes. Is it fair to say she wasn't a strong English speaker?
He made for a very funny interview.
And she also enlisted a friend to sort of stand next to the phone to help. So there was quite a lot of whispers stay off stage left, like, and then Andrew gamely, I don't know why we let the interview continue. It's sensational.
But it is a moment that I'll never forget. But I have to say, I mean, we made jokes here, but I kind of want to go to the Fête du Citron because at first I
what
said...
What happens there? Remind us.
At first I said, oh, they just sell lemons. I mean, it's fine. I can go to the supermarket. But basically, they do like carnival floats of dragons made of lemon and it looks amazing. And the whole festival takes about 2 weeks. It brings 200,000 visitors to that town and it does look amazing, to be honest. And I actually like lemons.
Sounds fantastic. Has Monocle done nothing with it since the abortive interview attempt?
I think we were traumatized, but I think we should come back next year.
I say, let's go this time next year. It sounds like a riot.
Is and it fair to say we could offer up some pithy coverage, you know, with a little zest?
Man, c'est parfait, you make me feel so sour. Well, Faye, thanks for joining us. It was, as ever, a pleasure to have you on for the News Look Ahead. You at home, listener, are with the Monocle Weekly. In just a moment, we'll be hearing from one of science fiction's most influential authors, none other than William Gibson.
Over recent years, genre fiction has experienced something of a change in fortunes, creeping from the margins to the centre as snooty, bookish types have come to realise that there's a lot more on offer than potboiler thrills. At the heart of this reappraisal is science fiction. Once firmly just for nerds like Augustine, modern audiences are awake to its potential to explore social, technological, or emotional vistas of thought.
William Gibson must surely rank highly among science fiction's greatest living practitioners. Since he coined the term cyberspace in his proto-cyberpunk classic Neuromancer, his reputation for prescience, coupled with his knack for spinning a profoundly entertaining tale, has found him favour with audiences from across the spectrum.
His latest book, Agency, follows up his last, The Peripheral, exploring a parallel present in which Hillary won in 2016 and the Brexit referendum returned a Remain result as it makes contact with a distant future inhabited by 80% fewer people, courtesy of a mass extinction event known as the Jackpot. Augustine sat down with William to learn more about it.
I'm afraid that if I try to give it an overview, I'll make it sound so witheringly complicated that no one will ever want to try to approach it.
Well, I think that's an interesting point because it is complicated. You know, especially, I read The Peripheral. Starting that, the first few pages, you're not really one for exposition, are you? So it takes a while to find oneself within the world that you create, understanding what's going on. But then when you do, while the plot seems complicated from the outset, it's actually more the framework that's complicated.
Yes, that's true. The necessary framework and mechanisms for the narratives of The Peripheral and of Agency are more complicated than most, I think. And perhaps they become a bit more complicated with Agency, but the narratives are human narratives. I think what science fiction often lacks for me is simple literary naturalism. I don't often get to know enough about some round sense of the character's life. It's something I like from fiction. I think I sort of try to go for a double dose of that in science fiction when I write science fiction.
I'm interested to hear your reflections on science fiction because I feel like for the people in the know, it's always existed at the kind of creative vanguard, exploring possible futures or different modes of behaviour. But it hasn't always been recognised for that. Much is made, and it's mentioned in your author's bio at the back of the book that you coined the term cyberspace. And I think maybe that was a point that, as that descriptor came to have more currency and became more widely known, maybe people at that point started to realise just what science fiction could do. But, you know, I think of authors like Ursula Le Guin or Octavia Butler, whose work was maybe as socially progressive as it was to do with technology.
Yes.
And who I think are now kind of encountering a serious readership. Why do you think people have maybe lost their negative associations with genre? Why are they more now awake to the possibilities of science fiction as a useful place to explore new ideas?
I think the one thing that's happened over the course of my having been a science fiction reader, and I began somewhere back in the mid-60s, something that's happened is that the world we live in has become progressively, steadily, much more a science fiction world. When I began to write science fiction, I believe it was possible, and you know, many people did this, to write a naturalistic contemporary novel in which you didn't need any of the toolkit of science fiction because what you were describing did not yet feel that much like science fiction. But even like further into the 60s or in the early 70s, the world, the real present, began to look so much more like a science fiction scenario that there were techniques in the toolkit of science fiction that it would enable you to write a better, realistic contemporary novel. I don't know if anyone ever really approached it that way, but I think it was true. And when I began to write science fiction, I did it with the assumption that science fiction really had never been about the future, because no one could know what the future was going to be. But that when the future read that science fiction from the past, they invariably read it as being, in some sense, about the moment in which it was written. I took that for granted, proceeded from there. I'm sure that recognition was really a big starting point for me, that it's not really about the future, and that the present is already consists of quite a lot of science fiction, more every day.
Within that, though, as I mentioned, this reputation for having been able to extrapolate from the present what the future may start to look like has triggered a reasonable amount, I would say, of dread across social media, you know, across various pieces of commentary when The Peripheral came out. I'm going to attempt a very broad brushstroke overview just so that we can discuss it. But The Peripheral, which precedes Agency, your new novel, takes place across two time periods. One is maybe a decade and a half in the future from where we are now, and the other is about a century ahead of us. And these two time periods are able to be in touch, and something has happened in between them that has made the century ahead look radically different to the world in the near future as you explore it in The Peripheral. In Agency, we have that same further future, but you're setting the preceding timeline in something that looks remarkably like the world we live in now, with a couple of notable exceptions, which are that Hillary Clinton's in the White House and Brexit never happened. Now, I wanted to ask about how these political catastrophes, some might say, have changed your shape, your perspective on the present and your outlook on the future, given that, you know, you were writing The Peripheral, which itself has some pretty apocalyptic visions before the sort of Western populist revolution even took place. So how have things changed now?
In that 22nd century London in The Peripheral is, for the sake of the narrative, that's our future, regardless of what happens. Everything that's happened since The Peripheral was published makes that future simply look all too likely, much more, even more likely than when The Peripheral was published. We see the beginning of the cleft that runs a large part of the world from the 22nd century London of The Peripheral. We see that beginning. The other stub, as they're called in The Peripheral, the other time track in Agency, is one in which someone intervened in, transtemporally intervened in, I believe, 2015, doing something that hasn't yet been determined, which had these two most evident outcomes are that Clinton won and that the Brexit referendum was for stay. So that world, as you encounter it in Agency, is just 22nd. It's like 2017 got a break, or it got two breaks. But in fact, once you're there, it's not all hokey-dory. No one even remembers there ever was a Brexit vote, which is would be the case if it had been stay. You know, you'd never talk about it. It was just a kind of goofy thing that didn't happen. If Trump had lost, I think immediately we would have all retroactively downgraded the possibility that he ever could have won. There would have been some long-form articles about the direness of the bullet we just dodged, but they wouldn't have been very widely read. Nobody would have cared. They'd be in the moment, and Clinton would be president, but, you know, still getting shit from the Democrats about her emails or whatever. But also in that 2017 stub of Agency, there's a looming nuclear crisis in the Middle East that has everyone totally on edge, that is sort of one of the MacGuffins of the narrative.
What happens in those kind of intervening years, whether it's between the future and further future of The Peripheral or that same further future and the alternate present of Agency, is called the jackpot. I don't want to kind of uncover it for anyone who hasn't read The Peripheral, but there's a certain bathos to the fact that it doesn't describe a single earth-changing event and rather looks ahead to the worst challenges, I suppose, that people are facing. I wanted to ask about how much you feel when you're sitting down to write these books, when you're thinking about the present, when you're thinking about technology and how it might develop and how it might impact on society, and when you're thinking about graver external threats to civilization or to societies as we know them, how much do you feel you have to report back accurately in your fiction? And to what extent do you reflect on these subjects with spinning a yarn in mind?
Well, the yarns I spin grow necessarily, at least in terms of my process, out of making the most honest measurement I can of how things seem to me to be going and where they seem likely to go. If we were able somehow magically to remove climate collapse from our list of stressors, we would still have a remarkable number of stressors waiting for us that we're coming up on. One of those, for instance, will be the point at which every antibiotic that you're familiar with the name of will have become completely useless and will have done so simply because we were so sloppy with the use and control of antibiotics. There's no other reason for the increasing existence of superbug variants of common diseases that just shrug off those antibiotics. It's just that we were slobs with it and weren't careful enough with using it. We have things going on with plastics in the ocean that will eventually create tremendous challenges and would do so even if the climate were fine. These all tend to be about unconsidered consequences of emergent technologies, or of technologies that have long since emerged, and we take them happily and absolutely for granted. But because we haven't been sufficiently careful with them, they're going to cause us very serious problems. So the jackpot is simply assuming that we'll receive all of those at more or less the same time, which I think we will, given that more or less the same time can mean like over the course of a century or two. And another thing about the jackpot is that our cultural model of an apocalypse or the apocalypse has always been of a relatively short-term event, as far as I know. I don't know of a single culture that's ever had like a 100-year apocalypse. I don't know what the longest ones ever have been, but usually it's like the night of or the 10 days of something, and then the world is gone, or the world as you knew it is gone. But we've never had cartoon characters standing on the sidewalk with a flax robe with a sandwich board that says, "Beware, the world is coming to an end in 200 years. We have nothing we can really do with that emotionally, perhaps because of it's longer than a human lifespan. So I think that's a big part of the confusion we're feeling now, is that we're looking at a long-term apocalypse that isn't going to be an overnight thing, but it's just going to keep on going unless we try to do something about it. May do so even if we do try to do something about it.
Thanks to William Gibson, and his new book, Agency, is out now. Do go and buy it. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24. Between 1932 and 1933, a man-made famine known as the Holodomor killed millions in Ukraine. A new film, Mr. Jones, explores the story through its account of journalist Gareth Jones, the first to report on the crime against humanity perpetrated by Stalin's regime.
Mr. Jones is the work of Andrea Chalupa, a journalist, author and screenwriter whose family connection to Ukraine and the Holodomor inspired her to write the film. She sat down with Monocle's Andrew Muller to talk about the history, the media, and how Ukraine is once more at the very heart of the story today.
Well, let's start with the title character of Mr. Jones, Gareth Jones, who was self-evidently somebody who led an extraordinary life and yet has somewhat fallen through history's cracks. Why do you think he's not better known?
I don't know. And I think his contemporaries should have done a far better job in raising awareness of who Gareth Jones was and the sacrifice he made for journalism. One journalist who does get credit for trying to raise awareness in a very big way for what was done to Gareth Jones was Eugene Lyons, a Marxist who very much went to the Soviet Union believing in the great socialist experiment, believing in Stalin. And he, at the time, was placed in Moscow as a reporter for UPI, United Press. And Eugene Lyons, who is featured in the film Mr. Jones, there's a great scene with James Norton interviewing Eugene Lyons in this lavish party and trying to get the truth out. And Eugene Lyons is stuck trying to speak in code to get through what's really happening and leave all these hints. The real Eugene Lyons went on to leave Moscow and write a tell-all called Assignment in Utopia. An entire chapter was dedicated to Gareth Jones. And the title of the chapter is called The Western Press Conceals a Famine. And it describes how when Gareth went on his illegal reporting trip into Ukraine, sneaking into the country, interviewing famine victims, and coming out and blowing the lid off this thing, Eugene Lyons describes how back in Moscow, this chief Soviet censor gathered together all the leading foreign correspondents, or many of them, into a hotel suite. They brokered a big deal saying, you know, you will go back to your newspapers and you will write articles saying that Gareth Jones is a liar. And in exchange, you'll get to keep your access to the Soviet regime. And that was the devil's bargain they made that night. And Eugene Lyons describes this in his memoir. And George Orwell comes along years later, reads this book, and writes a book review of it. So we know for a fact that Orwell would have been aware of what was done to Gareth Jones.
Because we should backtrack to recall what it was that got Gareth Jones into so much trouble while yet ensuring his immortality. He goes to the Soviet Union in the 1930s, and that is a period in which, for various reasons, some honourable, some not, quite a lot of the West is determined to believe that something actually marvellous is happening in the USSR under Joseph Stalin. And Gareth Jones both demonstrates and reports that this is very far from the truth. At the time, why did people not want to believe that?
Unfortunately, even today, there are people that don't want to believe this to this day, and they'll try to make justifications that Stalin's mass murderer, and some people did benefit by getting some advantages in Soviet society that they didn't have before. So even today, you come across people that try to justify this. Back then, it was just a simple matter of information being tightly controlled in the hands of the few. You had so many gatekeepers, where today Gareth Jones could have gone to Twitter and, you know, posted eyewitness videos that he took on his phone.
Very hard to imagine the USSR circa the 1930s being keen on Twitter.
Yeah, right. Obviously, in the digital age, he would have had a more even playing field than somebody like Walter Duranty, who played beautifully by Peter Sarsgaard in the film, who was the Walter Duranty, of course, was this great celebrity of his day. He was in Moscow for the New York Times. And not only that, he hosted all types of intellectual celebrities that would flock to Moscow to witness this great experiment. And Walter Duranty really outweighed Gareth here in this match. Gareth was a big fat nobody compared to Duranty, who was a celebrity and would play cards with other celebrities at the Gulkin Roundtable in New York City. And he was our man in Moscow. What he said went. He was the translator of the Soviet Union for the West. And so when he wrote in the New York Times, "There is no famine," that was it. That muddled the truth enough that Gareth was blacklisted, essentially discredited, and went back to Wales and covered local arts and crafts.
The key event that Gareth Jones was attempting to report on was what has become known as the Holodomor, which was this ghastly engineered famine in what was then the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. Your family has a personal point of connection with that story.
Yes. So my grandfather, who I was extraordinarily close with growing up in California, my grandfather was the world to me. We all had that person. We were lucky growing up. He would take me to get donuts and hot chocolate, and I would sing songs from, you know, I'd be Ariel and the Little Mermaid. I had a fantastic voice as a child. I lost it. So my grandfather just gave me such a sense of safety growing up. And I didn't learn until years later the horrific life that he had in Ukraine under Stalin. I remember vividly playing on the carpet of his office while he would be at his desk typing. And all those years he was typing his memoir. And it wasn't until I graduated university in 2004, I was incredibly disillusioned because it was the start of the Iraq War. Mm. My first job out of college was community organizer to try to stop Bush from getting a second term. The failure of that felt like a failure for the world. Utter lack of accountability of the corruption of the Bush-Cheney regime. And so I really needed a place to go and hide. And I essentially exiled myself to Ukraine. And I took my grandfather's memoir, typed in Ukrainian, because I needed some place to feel safe. And arriving in Ukraine with my grandfather, essentially in my arms in his memoir, I found a translator and I got his stories back. I was just amazed. I was reading about how he was a child on his family farm in eastern Ukraine witnessing battles of the Russian Revolution. He would go out into the field and collect bullet shells afterwards and thought that was really cool. And then he describes how society transformed. He and his family lived through the horrors of Stalin's genocide famine in Ukraine that killed millions across the Soviet Union, the vast majority Ukrainian. There was even a death certificate that survived from that time where the cause of death was listed as simply Ukrainian. And then my grandfather describes in his memoir of being a young father and being arrested during Stalin's purges and kept in prison and tortured. And then he describes the hell of, you know, the Nazi invasion coming in and the chaos and hell of that. So my grandfather witnessed the events that Orwell allegorized in Animal Farm. So that was one way that Orwell made his way into the script, Mr. Jones.
When you started working on this script, which you have been working on for a very long time.
Yeah, 1 million years.
Did its meaning change to you over that period? Because given that you started back when the world seemed relatively normal to what it is now, and certainly George Bush and Dick Cheney have acquired a weird nostalgic cachet.
We didn't think it could get worse from Bush-Cheney.
What with one thing and another. But did the meaning of the film change to you? I'm wondering whether you started out simply wanting to kind of tell your grandfather's story and also the story of this extraordinary and largely forgotten journalist, and then did it sort of grow on you that maybe there was a bigger story going on here and perhaps depressingly quite a contemporary one?
Oh, without question. Gareth Jones, being young and ambitious, he talked his way onto a plane with the new chancellor of Germany, Adolf Hitler. And he goes on and writes an article about it, where he opens up the article by saying, if this airplane should crash, the whole history of Europe would be changed.
That's quite the lead.
Yes. And he described the primal energy of Hitler's rallies. People were just primal. So as I was editing the screenplay with Agnieszka Holland, our director, in 2016, at one point I had the Republican convention in Ohio on TV in the background, and the fascist pageantry, I'm not kidding, the fascist pageantry of the Republican convention in 2016, the rise of Donald Trump, you had videos going viral of Trump supporters making the Nazi salute in the parking lot, right around the convention center. And here I am, like, editing a scene. It didn't make it into the film, but a scene with Hitler and Gareth trying to get that story and just thinking, I cannot believe this is happening again. And the reason it is all happening again is because authoritarianism is not creative. It's the same playbook throughout history. I want to be autocrats and autocrats rise to power. It's very much through Animal Farm. It's through fake, seductive promises. And that's why Orwell remains relevant, because these Trumps and Hitlers, they arrive on the scene and people underestimate them. They laughed at Hitler. There were establishment politicians that convinced themselves that Hitler could be contained. We now in the U.S., we're all out of babysitters. We don't know who's left in the White House to help protect our country from Trump and his family's worst urges. And so they've been shedding babysitters left and right in the White House. And we as Americans are asking ourselves, who is left to babysit?
Well, in the United States, the answer is supposed to be the American people.
You would think so, yeah.
You don't feel optimistic on that score?
Well, I mean, look at what happened with Iowa. We're still waiting for the results of the Iowa caucus because somebody in the Democratic Party, I mean, think about it. The Democratic Party, the DNC, suffered an act of war when Russian hackers came in and stole volumes of material, emails, documents, and so forth, and then weaponized that to divide the Democratic Party, weaken Trump's opposition, contributing greatly to helping bring Trump to power in 2016. And somebody in the Democratic Party did not stop and think, maybe we should go paper. Maybe we should rely on paper and pencils instead of going, you know, even further into the digital abyss at a time of hacking and cyber warfare. So that doesn't give me a lot of confidence. And I think it's very American that somebody wanted to make money off of our democratic system by selling an app. I think that's very disturbing.
It struck me that if there is a commonality between Gareth Jones's story and, I guess, somebody trying to tell truth about what is happening today, it is still that difficulty in persuading quite a lot of people to listen, even when something is actually demonstrably true. I know this is something you discuss in your book, Orwell and the Refugees, because it was no small change for George Orwell to get Animal Farm even published by anybody, never mind an actual Ukrainian edition, as he extraordinarily eventually managed to do. Do you think that's just one of those irreducible human flaws, that if something is going to in some way inconvenience or discombobulate people or make them have to rethink how they live their lives, they just prefer not to listen to it at all?
Oh, without question. I mean, think about how much easier life would be if we could all just stop caring. And I think Brave New World is the scarier dystopia because it's all about how we lose ourselves in drugs and sex. And I think today there's such a seduction to want to lose ourselves in Netflix instead of go out and do the hard work and convince ourselves to run for office and to flush the systems of the idiots that are corrupting our governments and our democracy. And I think it's up to all of us to stay vigilant and factor into our lives the necessary hard work to stay engaged by reading widely, by reading books by credible authors, by attending events, by showing up, by not just voting. I don't think voting's enough anymore. I think you have to really join a civic community where you live. And this, I will say to America's credit right now, especially as far as women are concerned, women's anger in America has become a political force. And you're seeing more and more women who sadly have a tendency to convince themselves out of doing things and not owning their power. Women are running for office in historic numbers for offices large and small. And they're creating their own independent media in large numbers. And they're not asking for permission anymore. And so you're seeing a lot more communities springing up and writing bills, learning how to write legislature. And it is extraordinary. And it has been an important way to protect the democracy we do have and hopefully flush out the system of these idiots that we've allowed to stay in power for so long. I do think, going back to the famine specifically, you know, Walter Duranty of the New York Times and Fox News of today, they don't just have to try to convince you that something isn't true or something didn't happen. All they have to do is create confusion. And that confusion, of course, is something that we all fall into the trap of. With the example of Stalin's genocide famine in Ukraine, there's widely documented research, including by leading historians like Norman Neymark of Stanford University, who wrote the book Stalin's Genocide, the Pulitzer Prize winning historian Ann Applebaum, who wrote Red Famine, Stalin's War in Ukraine, the Yale historian Timothy Snyder, who wrote Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin. They all have incredible documentation of Stalin's mass murder in this famine of 1932, 1933 being a genocide when you're deliberately taking food from people. Mm. For instance, I interviewed a survivor who described how she and her brothers were boiling a pot of twigs and mud and grass to feed themselves because that's what people had left to eat. Their food was systematically taken from them. And so they're boiling this pot of leaves and mud and grass, and along comes Soviet soldiers who take this pot and dump it out into the ground. It's not that they needed to grab that pot and sell it to raise money to help modernize the Soviet Empire. No, they were deliberately starving people. So before you had a nuclear bomb, the first weapon of mass destruction was organized starvation. It was, as Gareth Jones called it, a man-made famine. This was very clear genocide by anyone without a political agenda who objectively looks at the research, looks at the documentation that's available, the survivor testimony, the great moves that the Soviet authorities made to try to cover up the truth, including sealing the border of Ukraine, not letting the refugees out, and not letting journalists in. Everything they did amounts to genocide. And in fact, the lawyer, the human rights lawyer who first came up with the word genocide, his name was Raphael Lemkin, he used Stalin's famine in Ukraine as an example of genocide. The human rights lawyer, I want to repeat this again, the human rights lawyer who came up with the word genocide used Stalin's genocide famine in Ukraine as an example of what genocide is. And yet, today, we still have governments debating whether or not they're willing to recognize it as a genocide, even here in the UK. And you have to wonder, why are they afraid to acknowledge the truth? Is it because there's so much Russian money now in Leningrad? Is it because there's so much influence now among the oligarchs that own much of your media here, that they all sort of hang out at the same clubs and whatnot? And so you have to wonder, why can't we just acknowledge the truth as the truth? What is keeping us from acknowledging that?
Well, on that subject, if we look at another parallel between that informational hall of mirrors that Gareth Jones tried to negotiate and the one in which we presently live. There's kind of a family connection for you there as well, because your sister, Alexandra, who is a former DNC staffer, has had a walk-on role in the, or cameo role in the weird paranoid deep state narrative that Republican Party has been trying to assemble. As you understand it, what is her part in the great conspiracy to undermine the People's Sentinel, and how strange has that been to watch?
Yeah, so my sister's story, I mean, everything we're talking about is enough already, and then you add my sister's story, which makes it sound even more surreal. So I have to say, my sister, Alexandra Chalupa, she's just a regular American mom of three kids.
That's what she wants us to think.
Well, it's surreal because, you know, she drives a minivan, and this whole Fox News, Kremlin state, Russian propaganda apparatus, they're echoing each other. They're feeding off each other to try to present my sister as some Ukrainian Illuminati. It's for the simple fact that in the 2016 election, when I was busy editing the screenplay and really blown away by history repeating and why no one was stopping it, we had in this political climate in the U.S. this feeling that, yes, Trump is horrifying, but there was also an arrogance by many in the media, and I would even say in the Clinton campaign, that there's no way Trump's going to win. And you had all these stupid, these shiny, fancy graphics by the New York Times and other leading media showing Hillary's chances of winning being like 99%. Mm. You know, and so all of us were like, we just have to survive and we'll get rid of him. And then he'll go off to Fox News and have his own show. So I think everybody underestimated how determined the Kremlin was to help bring Trump to power. There's even a phenomenal documentary called, I believe, The Final Year, where documentary crew followed Obama's foreign policy team around for the final year. And they show on election night this total meltdown of Trump winning. And there's footage of Ben Rhodes, who was considered President Obama's foreign policy mind. Ben Rhodes turns the camera and says, well, I guess we underestimated Putin. And it's like, yes, of course you did. And so anyone like me and my sister who were following events in Ukraine very closely, because in America, we have this melting pot where it's a thing of pride to be an immigrant. Our parents were born in refugee camps. They grew up in New York City with barely anything. They both knew hunger growing up, and they both achieved the American dream. My father's a neuroscientist who has done a great deal to advance research into how the mind works, how the brain works, and autism research, cancer research, and others. And my mother, our mother, was a grassroots activist who passed the child car seat law in California. And she did that when she had me and my sister because she wanted to keep us safe. My sister, as a child, survived a horrendous car accident, and it was her car seat that saved her life. And my mother turned that into a law, a state law in California. Like, my mother used to change my diapers on a senator's desk. So my parents achieved the greatness of the American dream. And so my sister and I always felt civically obligated to give back to that. And so we stayed engaged. We would, you know, always stay active in elections. And we always felt proud of our Ukrainian heritage. And when the revolution happened in Ukraine, we helped launch Digital Maidan, hashtag Digital Maidan, an SOS hashtag drawing attention to how protesters were being beaten up fighting for democracy in Kyiv. And we organized with other Ukrainian diaspora in trying to raise, you know, funding to help Ukrainians there and fact check the Kremlin's propaganda against Ukraine's revolution. And so all of those things, you know, following Ukraine so closely, when Paul Manafort, who helped destroy Ukraine under Viktor Yanukovych, Putin's puppet, when Paul Manafort came over to manage Donald Trump's campaign for president, that was like Darth Vader coming over. And so seeing Paul Manafort on the Sunday talk shows in the U.S., given these softball questions, we were out of our minds. Like, is anybody going to say something? Like, this is very dangerous. And so the American establishment in the media and in the political world underestimated the Kremlin's influence on Donald Trump's victory in 2016. But we didn't, because we'd been following Ukraine so closely. My sister spoke out about it a lot at the time. And really, you know, she was screaming to anybody that would listen. And as punishment, there's been, you know, reporting that's come out that Paul Manafort has directed the Trump regime and worked with the Kremlin to target her and blame her and Christopher Steele and the FBI, and trying to say that they were the ones that hacked the 2016 election. and it was Ukraine and that hacked the, and all of it is all lies. And it just goes to show, like, you know, the hell that she's been under, the death threats, the harassment, this giant cesspool on social media of far-right idiots trying to create this whole fake narrative. Like, they create all these like homeland carry maps about her and connect her to people she's never met. And it's just the most surreal thing to write a film about a whistleblower and at the same time see my sister go through the hell of what it's like to actually be a whistleblower. And I wouldn't have wanted any of this. When I start, I just wanted to make a film to honor my grandfather. And it sucks that we're now stuck repeating history in such an intimate, horrible way.
Thanks to Andrea Chalupa and Andrew Muller. And Mr. Jones is in cinemas now. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly.
You're with The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Tom Edwards and Augustin Macellari in the chairs today. Now, here in London, Flowers Gallery has been a cornerstone of the city's art scene since it opened back in 1970. Over the years, it's exhibited the likes of Eduardo Paolozzi, Bridget Riley, Anish Kapoor and Richard Deacon, to name but a few.
As it prepares to celebrate its 50th birthday tomorrow, 10th of February, I sat down with Matthew Flowers, the managing director and son of founder Angela, to hear his reflections on how the art world has changed over the years and to learn how Flowers Gallery has kept pace.
The gallery was started by my mum, Angela Flowers, in 1970 in a very small space in the middle of Chinatown. It grew through the decades into a very large space in Shoreditch now and space in Cork Street in the West End, further outlets in New York and Hong Kong in the foreseeable future.
It's amazing, really. I'm sort of interested to know because, you know, in the 70s, London, much like New York, very different places, arguably more hospitable to artists and a bit less hospitable to collectors themselves who maybe weren't as into the kind of rough and tumble of it. How have you adjusted to keep pace with the developments, social, economic developments, as well as in the art scene?
The art world was a much smaller place in the 70s. There were very few contemporary galleries. It really was pioneering at that in that period. And so it wasn't a big market. There weren't many collectors. I think the British saw themselves as a literary nation, not a visual arts country. And what happened is that things started to open up, I would say, towards the late 80s, when you had everything from art fairs taking place in London. You had the Contemporary Art Society art market, where people could go and buy a painting and put it in a Sainsbury's bag. It became more accessible, and so it started to proliferate and more collectors got a lot of publicity and it started to stick and the collectors started buying. And so the market has grown tremendously, but it doesn't necessarily make it easier because there are more galleries. The competition has grown at the same pace.
Of course. You mentioned those sort of things in the late 80s, the YBAs, these movements kind of bringing art into the public consciousness. But I wonder, you know, how has the kind of makeup of the collector changed, do you think?
It's many different kinds of collectors. I think it used to be professionals, doctors, lawyers, bankers, of course. But I think that it's really opened up, and you've only got to see the numbers that attend the art fairs like Frieze or London Art Fair or the Print Fair. So many people of different walks of life. So I don't think there's any kind of collector now. At the top end, of course, we still rely very heavily on investment bankers, hedge funders, film stars, pop stars, people with enormous wealth. But I think we've always been involved in nurturing young, emerging talent. And so the works often start at lower price levels and are more accessible to a wide audience.
I wonder, like, how you must have some really incredible relationships with individuals, not just artists, but also collectors that you've kind of grown over those years.
Yes, some of the relationships have been incredibly close. The way we sell art has changed enormously because we relied on people obviously having to see the actual work in the 70s, 80s, but pre-email, pre-JPEG, digital images. And now there's a big hunger that is through websites, online art platforms. People can see work very easily now. And I think that incredibly, people are actually confident to buy works of art when they haven't actually seen them in the flesh. Mm. One time, my mum opened the back of her cottage in West Cork in Ireland. This is in the mid-80s. And would invite collectors from London, even further afield. And they would come on in a sort of organized plane trip and coach and would stay for a long weekend and have meals and drinks and partying, ended with a table tennis tournament. And it was a very friendly atmosphere, but of course the hope was that they would go away with a little painting as well.
It seems like the way people look at art is kind of starting to change. You know, I was interested to see that I think last year Marlborough Gallery repositioned itself so that it wasn't any longer a kind of fine art or a contemporary art space where there was a division between the two, but rather it sort of become more expansive, will exhibit a broader range of things from different time periods. Do you think that that's a relatively recent trend? Are people becoming less sort of hierarchical about how they look at and how they value artworks?
I think we're all having to reinvent ourselves the whole time. You can't just work on one formula and think it will last for decades. You've got to keep looking at new things. So, you know, at one time, maybe we're working with more limited edition prints or monoprints so that there's more accessibility, lower prices, or doing exhibitions of smaller works, bringing in new artists to stimulate new collectors so that maybe they'll look at some of your old school artists who are more expensive. So I think we're all in different ways looking for new ways to get a public excited about looking at art and buying it.
You mentioned there building relationships with maybe emerging artists rather than ones who are kind of fully formed to enjoy great celebrity. How important is it to then maintain that? I mean, it seems like the kind of the way an artist and a gallery interact is kind of quite important in the work that's eventually formed.
Yes, for me, it's the lifeblood of the gallery. And we're always looking for new people. Of course, you've got to look after the artists you're representing and keep focused on what they're doing. One show I'm very proud of that we've been doing since 1983 is Artist of the Day, where we invite 10 well-known or established artists to select someone they think could benefit from a one-day exhibition. So we run it in our Cork Street space in the West End, which isn't too big, and every night we hang a new exhibition. And it's on just for one day, and 7 o'clock in the evening it comes down and we're hanging the next one. So it means, even though we haven't actually chosen the artist being seen, we get to present, at a very minimum, 10 brand new artists. Probably during a year we would take on one new artist as well, maybe even from Artist of the Day. But so that was something where we really wanted to make sure we were still finding new people. And it's also a way of engaging critics and interest from people who maybe think, oh, I know that gallery, I know what they do. So you've got to liven things up.
You've mentioned a couple of bits of curatorial kind of experimentation there with the open house in Cork as well. Looking towards the future, is that something that you're very much keen to kind of proceed with?
Well, we've done some very interesting group exhibitions. My mum did an exhibition of postcards in 1970 or 71, I think it was, so pretty much in the first year of the gallery. She brought in artists like Joseph Beuys, David Hockney, Richard Hamilton, Peter Blake. In later years, we've done Small is Beautiful, which is because everything is maximum size 9 by 7 inches. As well as having our artists, we can bring in some well-known artists we know and a number of young emerging artists too. We like to have a themed shows as well, which again brings in different kind of talents that we wouldn't necessarily think are what we normally do. So we go out of our comfort zone occasionally.
You mentioned just at the beginning that you have a gallery pending opening in Hong Kong, where obviously things are, at the moment, at the time of recording certainly, a little tricky. China has been an incredible area for economic growth. It's extended into the art market, and most big galleries do seem to now have a presence in East Asia. I wonder where you're looking in terms of emerging markets over the next sort of 50 years.
We've been very excited the last 5 years in Hong Kong and the potential it has. I suppose the way we see Hong Kong is a gateway, and it's not just to China mainland. It's also Korea, Vietnam, Japan and Australia and many other countries. There are private museums being built. There's an enormous enthusiasm. And of course, there's some extraordinarily good artists too. So it widens our horizons, but it's also a market for our existing artists.
In terms of, broadly speaking, the next sort of 50 years, have you how far ahead are you looking? What kind of plans are you making? Is it kind of, do you have a decade sort of mapped out?
Not really, but I think I've decided that I don't particularly like the idea of expanding into bigger. I think that it's a time to maybe think smaller. And I quite like our approach in Hong Kong, where we've had someone looking after the business in terms of doing art fairs and pop-up exhibitions, visiting museums. And now we've got this space. But it's very small. It's beautifully designed. And I see it as a more organic approach. So I could see us opening maybe in one or two other interesting places like Berlin. But it would be not to have mega galleries and showing enormous works. It would be somewhere where we can meet with people and have a dialogue. It's very easy to see images now on screens. And easy to present works at art fairs and museums. So that's one idea. But there are plenty more. They just take a little while to come out.
Thanks to Matthew Flowers, and Flowers Gallery celebrates its 50th anniversary with exhibitions across its Cork Street and Kingsland Road branches. So do head along and join the festivities. This is the Monocle Weekly. There you have it, Augustine, another Monocle Weekly bites the dust. Now, they say never meet your heroes, but I'm sure you'd beg to differ after spending some quality time with none other than legendary William Gibson.
Yeah, what can I say? He was a charming man. It was fascinating to talk to him, not just about the book, which is excellent, but also about his kind of attitude towards science fiction, this idea that rather than trying to predict the future, it's just a really robust exploration of the present. And that kind of is borne out in his work. You know, he's not looking at technologies, well, with the exception of some in the far future, but he's not looking at technologies that haven't been invented yet. He's looking at technologies that we have, but that we haven't really realised the full capacity or uses of yet.
This is very much how the Monocle Weekly rolls. An eye on the future, an eye on the present, a brilliant movie, Mr. Jones, in cinemas now, and a bit of an eye, yeah, on the present and past. Lovely to celebrate Flowers Gallery with Matthew Flowers himself. A success story that's bloomed in London over half a century. Do you like that?
Yeah, I guess so. It's the picture of health, isn't it?
Very much so. Org, let's thank our friends behind the glass for their work on this week's programme.
I produced today's show, and our studio managers were Maylie Evans and Louis Allen.
The Monocle Weekly will be back, of course, at the same time next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Tom Edwards.
And from me, Augusta Macellari.
Goodbye.
Bye.